smile through her tears and just thank you with all she can say. Though the rest of the world may be gay, there's sadness in her heart today. And that wandering one never knows what he's done when the mailman says no mail today. It's just an old story, you've heard it before, of someone who's wandered from his mother's door. She waits for a letter as the mailman goes by, and her heart is breaking as she hears his reply.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and today's program includes Paul Gilding and Richard Heidenberg, and they talk about what kind of economy we will have as the economic crisis meets the environmental crisis.
Richard Heidenberg is a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. Our other guest today at Climate One is Paul Gilding, a professor at Cambridge University's Program for Sustainability Leadership. Peak oil was mentioned, and we've had a lot of people here who talk about peak oil, a lot of people who dismiss it, a lot of people who subscribe to it. Let me just challenge a little bit on peak oil. Every time someone mentions peak oil, there's a big new find in the Arctic or in Cuba or off the coast of Brazil. And people would say the technology that's being applied to fracking of natural gas will get increase the yields from known oil wells. There's no peak oil.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true we are finding new oil. What's happening is we're replacing giant deposits of high quality, cheap to produce, quick to produce oil with deposits of low quality, hard to access, expensive and slow to produce oil. So it's not as though we're running out. What's actually being discovered these days is fairly trivial fields as compared to the ones that were being found in the 1950s and 60s. So yes, we are finding more, but what we're seeing in real time in terms of price and production is since 2005, global crude oil production has been flat. Last 6 years, almost 7 years, and that's in the context of very high prices that would bring to market all of the oil that that could be produced. The evidence suggests that we're at a plateau right now that is going to lead probably within the next 2, 3, 4 years to declining world oil production. That's not to say that new technology won't produce more marginal oil from some sources, but it's sort of like we're getting better and better at scraping the bottom of the barrel.
We had an economist here last week from UC Berkeley who said if renewables are successful in displacing oil, take out 10 to 15% of the oil market, the price collapsed back to $15 or $20 where it was for decades. Possible?
I think this is, Richard's the peak oil expert, but let me talk about renewables a little bit, because I think there is just amazingly exciting things happening in that space. And I do think that we can look forward to some pretty dramatic breakthroughs in the cost of solar in particular, but across the board in terms of renewables. And think about the solar energy industry globally has been growing at 40% per year, right? And every time it doubles, the price goes down by 20%. So if you apply that to any other industry, you would say, well, you know where it's going. It looks like mobile phones, digital cameras, et cetera. So we're seeing exceptional takeoff. Now, in that context, I think it becomes very hard to predict oil prices, very hard to predict, you know, behaviour in the economy broadly. However, it takes a long time to drive the change physically. Right, so I do think we are going to see much cheaper solar power. I do think solar is going to be cheaper than coal, certainly in a decade, probably less. Certainly China is, you know, working towards grid parity for solar, right? So solar going into the grid at the point of production. being as cheap or cheaper than coal from a new coal-fired power station. So if that happens, then the game changes quite dramatically. However, the problem is that they actually change, for example, if we change the entire global auto fleet to electric cars, that's a long process. And so those things don't happen overnight.
And the incumbents fight it. You're from Australia, where I believe the largest global coal exporter. The coal companies aren't just going to sit by and watch this happen.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. Right? And really annoying. But to be expected, and to be expected a lot more of, you know, in the coming years, is they are fighting tooth and nail. They are going to do whatever it takes to defend their patch. And it's up to government to overcome that and to have the courage to actually stare them down and to enforce the change, which is what's been happening in Australia. We just had a carbon tax going through the parliament in the last few weeks.
And I was told that that looks a little bit like Swiss cheese. There's some carve-outs for to get it through, but you think it's still an effective step to
look,
put it...
I think the key thing is that we're going to cross that dreaded line that you haven't crossed yet, which is that we're saying nationally we have to deal with the issue. Right? Mm-hmm. So the price itself is very low. There are many many compensating factors for coal and oil companies and so on, but the point is that there is now a price on carbon, or soon will be in Australia, which means every balance sheet shows the cost of carbon. And once the business community and markets understand that there is a consequence to emitting carbon, the psychological shift of that is quite significant. So economically it's not so important yet, but in terms of the symbolism, it's very powerful, and it means we no longer have a debate about whether we should act on climate or not. We only have a debate on how we should act and how fast we should act, which is a very different context than the new poor people are having here.
And, us Americans. One of you quotes Joseph Schumpeter, the idea of creative destruction, that this is quite natural for this kind of destruction within industries, that then out of the decay of one sector or technology sprouts something very new and vibrant.
And this is the techno-optimist view of the world sort of on steroids, if you like, is that creative destruction is a good thing, right, and that we will always have that. And it's true that markets always, you know, reform and change. And if you looked at the Dow Jones 30 years ago, 60 years ago, of course, it would be completely different. Google didn't exist. Microsoft, existed 30 years ago, et cetera. So that happens. But it doesn't happen that fast. And it doesn't happen at that scale to take out big oil companies overnight.
And it happens a lot slower in energy than it does software and technology.
Correct.
Technology goes in months, software goes in months and weeks, and energy infrastructure goes in decades.
And that's a big national economic issue when you have a lot of money invested in the infrastructure of that. So when you have train lines to carry coal, when you have ports to carry oil and gas, you know, when you have that thing built in and you're spending billions of dollars on that and you depend upon that for the strength of your economy, it's not as easy as changing a mobile phone.
Richard, you also talk about peak phosphorus and the idea of peak food. That was a new one for me. I've heard of peak plutonium and peak lithium because of all the in car batteries. But let's talk about the food aspect of this.
Right. Well, we've built a food system that is basically a way of propping up plants while we feed them fossil fuels. Also, we use fossil fuels for transporting inputs to the farm, transporting outputs from the farm ultimately to the consumer's plate, typically around 1,500 miles on average in North America. So we're investing about 7 calories of fossil fuel energy in the food system for every calorie of food that we get out at the end of the day. So in the context of a system where oil is becoming more scarce and expensive, this is a prescription for higher food prices, which is, of course, is exactly what we're seeing. If you look at a graph of food prices over the past decade and a graph of oil prices for the past decade, they're moving in lockstep. And this is one of the factors that's leading to social disruption around the world. Poor people who have to spend a large portion of their income on food are finding themselves in a situation of desperation now. And that's only going to get worse until we make fundamental changes in the entire food system to localize it, to reduce the reliance on fossil fuel inputs. We know how to do these things. There are perfectly good models, but they have to be applied. It has to become a matter of policy.
And that's happening some places. Local food, sustainable food is happening, but that tends to be viewed as sort of a coastal elite kind of thing.
Yeah,
not
it's,
happening
it's
in the
a
heartland.
Boutique phenomenon,
right?
But it has to become the standard mainstream way of providing food for people. During World War II, we saw a situation where something like 40% of fruits and vegetables were being grown in people's backyards because the government suddenly decided that this was an important program. We need to be doing something similar to that right now.
And it should be remembered how much we can do that. I mean, the victory gardens, as they were called, that Richard refers to, I mean, there are very good examples of history where we can change we can turn on a dime when we choose to do so. So when we have a crisis, and it's called an officially declared crisis, which is what you have in a war, then we can change, and people are capable of change, and government's capable of driving that change to occur. So I think we should be careful with the kind of the crisis is the end kind of scenario. The crisis is the trigger for the change.
Crisis is necessary. In fact, you, Paul Gilding, you write about gas rationing and grounding planes. There's some pretty strong stuff in there. When we hit the wall, you're talking about a very heavy government hand in the marketplace and some things that would not be considered absent that crisis.
Correct. And I think we go back to World War II to think of examples where that does work and works in a democracy. You know, you can still have a democracy, you can still have businesses, still have markets functioning, but government has to direct the change to occur rapidly. It wouldn't have had to if we acted 30 years ago. We left it too late to do it quickly. Therefore, you have to have the change occur. However, business still succeeds. Markets still deliver things. It's just that government has to put in place the framework around it, the expectations of what we need to have. And we have to elect the governments that will do that. And we're certainly capable of that level of change once we choose to embark upon that path.
Paul Gilding is a professor at Cambridge University's Program for Sustainability Leadership. Our other guest today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. I'm Greg Dalton. But let's talk about that World War II analogy. During World War II, the enemy was visible. Mm-hmm. This time, the enemy is us, and we're not visible. I mean, right? It's carbon, you can't see carbon. You can see Hitler.
Yes and no. So a couple of things about that. First of all is that let's remember that we were in denial about the threat of Japan and Germany in World War II for a long time. And the arguments were scarily similar, right? The threat isn't that bad, right? We can't afford to respond. The people won't tolerate that level of change, right? All the same arguments were used, and then suddenly we changed. Now, we changed for a physical, you know, events in the case of Pearl Harbor. But people always say, oh, yes, but the invasion of Poland. What's the invasion of Poland that is the equivalent for Europe today? And the answer, of course, is that, well, Poland was the trigger in hindsight, but it was actually the third country that Hitler took over. Why didn't we wait for France? Why didn't we wait for the next one? And the answer is we pick a trigger, and then historians say that was the trigger, right? And then we respond. And I think, you know, if you look at this in terms of climate change or resource constraint, if you look back historically, we will say, well, it was bloody obvious. 2008, record oil prices, record food prices, global economic collapse. We were in denial for a few more years, but in 2010, we hit record food prices again. We had the global economy going into the meltdown again. You know, we had the worst floods on record in Pakistan. We had the hottest year on record, 2010, around the world, et cetera, et cetera. But we still didn't change. So, yes, the point is we are still waiting for that trigger, but the pattern of behaviour is very consistent in humans, is that you avoid it, you stay in denial as long as you possibly can, and then you change. And if anyone knows a drug addict or an alcoholic, you know, when do they change? When the wife leaves, when they lose the job, when they're in the gutter. You know, pick your own crisis to respond to. But then what we have now is that we're lying in the gutter, you know, and we're saying we really like it down here. It's excellent. I love it.
You know?
But we will, in actual fact, respond.
Australia's been through some epic biblical droughts and floods recently. Has Australia wakened up? Is that part of why the reason why a carbon tax got through in Australia?
Look, I think we do our best to stay with America whenever we can. You know, in wars, anytime we can, we try and follow you as closely as possible. But on this one, I'm afraid we've diverted just slightly. We still have a very kind of anti-climate change Republican equivalent party. But the big difference in Australia is they don't deny the climate science. And I think that's why. I think as we've had the hottest bushfires on record by a factor of two or three, right? So the worst bushfires in terms of scale. We've had floods, as you said, covering an area the size of France and Germany. We've had phenomenal droughts and so on before that. So, yes, we've had those things. And so the debate in Australia is really one about how we act on climate change and whether we should go now or later, not whether we should act. And I think the jury is definitely in terms of the climate science, and that's a big difference, I think, because of the physical impacts.
Richard, you want to jump in here in terms of denial or when we're going to finally wake up?
I think our country has a larger capacity for denial.
It's one of our core strengths, yes.
Yes, and I think we're seeing, I mean, look at what's happening in Texas right now with the record drought, and yet... Still, that state is very largely Governor Perry is a major climate denier. So, yeah, I think we're going to have to hit the wall before we see fundamental change. But this is in some ways it's a slow motion crash, but it could have very very rapid components to it. And I think the financial system is an aspect of the system as a whole that is capable of crashing very rapidly, and there's the prospect for that to occur, I think, even within the next couple of years.
And just if I can just add on that issue of denial as an outsider, I think the context is very important here, and that is that, you know, we always stay in denial for a long time on these major issues, and the worse the evidence gets that attacks that denial, the stronger the denial has to become to defend itself. So it's like an organism. Right. So the evidence in the US now is so overwhelming in terms of the droughts and wildfires in Texas and so on. I mean, you've had so much evidence and it's so clear globally and locally. So why is the denial so strong? Because it has to be to defend itself against the evidence. Right. But at some point, that still breaks through. So I look around at America and kind of laugh, as opposed to despair, about the level of denial, because you know it's about to end. Right, because that's what denial does. It gets more and more extreme. I'm sort of waiting for someone to argue for the we should get rid of all airline regulations because gravity is only a theory, you know. And and there is that sort of point where it becomes absurd, and you do laugh about it because it's so irrational, and so in denial of the evidence that you know it can't last. Because we're not irrational. This is not an irrational country, right? It's a highly educated, scientifically literate country, right? And so it is going to change in that regard at some point.
And you write also that there's a risk, though, in ceding U.S. leadership, that there are some other countries, China, that's going ahead, that could risk to undermine the moral authority of democracy, right? That you know, the longer the U.S. and other democracies sort of stay stuck on this, that the great disruption could undermine democracy. Mm-hmm. That was really interesting.
Fundamentally, what we're seeing right now in the U.S. is a challenge to the political system as it exists. The political system has become sclerotic. It's become a creature, in effect, of Wall Street. And now we have people out on the street demanding fundamental change in that. And the demands are not finely crafted. It's not really clear what's being asked for. But at the same time, virtually all Americans understand that the level of economic inequality in the country has grown to socially unsustainable levels. And this is provoked into crisis by the failure of economic growth. As long as the economy was growing, it was possible to paper over all of these problems, the political problems, the corruption on Wall Street and so on. But as growth comes to an end, suddenly all of these problems bubble out to the surface and they become ones that can't be ignored anymore.
And I think in a global context, I think the China story is really very, very important. And I think the reason it's so important is because if they're more capable of responding to this crisis, right, then the symbolism to the rest of the world becomes really powerful. Okay, so America can't respond, is in decline economically, can't cope with this sort of ecological resource crisis. China is strong economically, has money in the bank, is bailing out European countries, right, is leading the world on clean tech and has a future. So on the surface, that looks like pretty straightforward, right? Democracy is in decline, autocracy is on the rise. However, then it gets more complicated because then you look at South Korea, you look at Taiwan, you look at Japan, you look elsewhere and you see actually there are democracies that are responding differently and they are responding in the democratic context with strong government action. So I think the threat maybe to democracy, and I think that's quite a powerful argument, certainly in the Middle East at the moment, but it may also be to weak government. The threat may not be so much to democracy as the idea that markets should be let free to roam without constraint, because that idea is failing very badly, right? And the reason the Chinese economy is booming is it's a capitalist economy just without democracy. Right? And that's a very different context.
And those Asian democracies that you mentioned have a stronger government hand guiding the marketplace. Yep. And, you know, Singapore, Japan, and some of those countries have very industrial policies that are very different. So it's a different form of state capitalism versus the market capitalism that we have here.
I think it's really very important to unpack that quite accurately, because I think it is a different kind of idea. It is that markets are good, that capitalism is a great way of allocating capital, right, and testing technologies and making things happen. And, of course, you have to have government rules around that to work, as we do everywhere. I mean, when people say we should let the market rip, just let the market do its work and we don't need government, I say, look, well, let's start with contract law. So let's take out contract law, because trust should be a market force. If you don't behave with trust, we won't do business with you anymore. And then they, especially the Wall Street bankers, scream at that point, oh, no, have to have those limits. Okay, so let's talk about which limits we have then. Right, and of course you have to have limits. And so I think the answer is not central planning, not state capitalism, but government strength to constrain and guide the market, but leave the market do what it does well, which is not, you know, dealing with environmental issues without intervention.
Paul Gilding is a professor at Cambridge University and author of The Great Disruption. Other guest here today at Climate One is Richard Heinberg, senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of The End of Growth. I'm Greg Dalton. Paul, you mentioned allocating capital. I'd like to ask you and Richard, where you allocate your personal capital, knowing that the bust is coming. Where are you squirreling away your own money?
Well, my wife Janet and I have spent the last 10 years retrofitting our suburban Santa Rosa home for energy efficiency, solar panels for electricity and also for hot water, solar food dryer, solar cooker, three chickens in the backyard, 25 fruit and nut trees.
You're getting ready.
That's basically where we've put our effort. I think it's local resilience is really going to be the name of the game. There's, as Paul has been describing, there's a great deal that central governments can and should be doing. But in a situation where, in this country, we have a national government that is very largely dysfunctional, it's going to be really very much up to local communities, states, and but especially cities and counties, to develop more resilience. And that means more local inventories, more local production, less specialization, more generalization. These are basic sort of principles, but the way that expresses itself in real life is by people becoming more self-sufficient.
Paul? Yeah, I think very similar in the sense that I'm living on a farm in Tasmania, in the belief that it's a long way south, so it's very cold, which has a lot of margin for error. And also, likewise, in terms of a fair bit of food self-sufficiency in that process. But also, I think, I mean, the joy of being writers is you don't have to worry much about capital and its investment, which is good. But I do think, seriously, if you did have money, then I think we're looking at a period of rapid change and volatility. So people like Jeremy Grantham, you know, argue there's great opportunity in that space, which there is. Because some companies will boom in this area, some economies will do well, some will do badly. You know, I think it's a skillful investor to understand how that process is going to unfold.
can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.